Hello. Before we settle into this edition of the Books Podcast, I wanted to tell you more about our sponsor, Squarespace. Create a beautiful website or online store with one of Squarespace's award-winning templates. It'll display perfectly on your Kindle, iPad, desktop, or whatever. Head to squarespace.com/guardian and enter the offer code GuardianBooksPod to get 10% off your first purchase. And now, on with the show.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast. This week we're looking back on two giants of 20th century culture. One is a person, the singer, actor and activist Paul Robeson, and the other is a novel, Ishmael Reed's Mumbo Jumbo, which was cited by Harold Bloom as one of the 500 most important books in the Western canon. Reed's 1972 novel's just been reissued by Penguin Classics, complete with its original photographs, adverts, programme notes and handwritten scribbles. Whilst in a new biography, No Way But This, Australian author and broadcaster Jeff Sparrow goes on a grand world tour of the United States, the Welsh Valleys, key locations of the Spanish Civil War and Russia in search of Paul Robeson. On the surface, the two books might seem to have little in common, but they both take us back to 1920s Harlem, where Robeson first found fame and where, in Reed's satirical fantasy, the Jez Grew virus is driving people crazy with dance. Jez Grew, as in It Just Grew, is a dangerous mix of ragtime, jazz, polytheism, and a lust for freedom which only infects black people. We begin with an excerpt from a dramatisation of Mumbo Jumbo and a warning. In the clip and subsequent interview, there's explicit language and some potentially upsetting descriptions. Here, three hoods find themselves on a suspiciously quiet road.
Collection day. Three Packards roll up to a store in Harlem. The street is unusually quiet.
Where is it?
I don't know.
Where are the salesmen, the new Negroes, the ham heavers, the pot wrestlers, the kitchen mechanics? Should be on their way to work.
Oh, boss.
Where are the sugar daddies and their hookers, the peddlers, the traffic cops, the reefer salesmen standing on the corner?
I don't know.
No revelers. No chippies. What?
Huh?
No Rembrandt Dutch masters. Look at that.
Who's that?
That is a picture of Prince Hall, founder of African Lodge number one of the Black Masons.
Black Masons?
Yeah.
What's Daddy's home?
That's a charter the Black Freemasons received from England.
Huh?
Something's fishy.
Hey, boss. This store here ain't got no Dutch masters, too.
Prince Hall again. Call the Packers.
Hey! Hey!
Look, boys. We got a bit of a problem.
Dad! Buddy Jackson's dead!
Jeff Sparrow joined me in the studio with Ishmael Reed on a rather crackly line from his home in Oakland, California. I began by asking Ishmael, although he names many real people, including the sociologist and civil rights activist W.E.B. Du Bois, a friend of Robeson's, does he actually mention Robeson himself?
I mentioned a very famous incident that took place in Peekskill, New York, where Robeson was performing and was assaulted by a mob. And my connection to that is Bumpy Johnson, who was a Harlem gangster. And according to legend, Bumpy Johnson tried to rescue him from the mob. That's my only mention of Robeson in the book.
Did you ever meet him or hear him or see him?
I never, that's a little bit before my time. I think that Robeson's career brought him detractors and admirers. For example, there was always a clash between the Communist Party and black nationalism, dating back to the 20s. And when Robeson performed what Marcus Garvey, who was the leader of a black nationalist movement, considered demeaning roles in Hollywood, Robeson left Hollywood, according to some sources, because of Marcus Garvey's criticism. He wrote a pamphlet criticizing some of those demeaning movies and musicals.
Yeah, so, and Jeff, your biography is actually makes a big point of this, doesn't it? This sort of schism in him of being a bit really wanting to be a black activist, but also being very wedded to the white establishment and to the success that it brought him.
Yeah, I mean, Robeson's career was circumscribed by the extraordinary racism that he was born into in Princeton in 1898. And, you know, according to one estimate, that the 1890s were so violent that a person was being lynched every second day throughout the entirety of that decade. And so Robeson forged both his musical and theatrical career in an environment of essentially apartheid in America. And so particularly as an actor, you're dependent on other people, you're dependent on producers and directors, and he was constantly being shunted into roles that were demeaning or were sometimes scripts that were sometimes even racist. And the entirety of his career, particularly his early career, was about trying to overcome that, trying to transform these roles into something that was less demeaning, that he could express what he really felt. And, you know, I mean, even when he went into Hollywood, that was something that followed him all through his career. Whereas in music, I think that he had more freedom, because as a singer, he could sing the music that he wanted to sing in a way that wasn't necessarily an option in terms of his theatrical career.
His roles were, in terms of theatre, were pretty classical, weren't they? He played Othello three times, starting in the 1940s.
Well, Othello was the great part for African-American actors, because it's the one canonical role where the protagonist is a person of colour, and a person of colour who is portrayed as a great general, and so it's not seen as a demeaning role. But of course, when Robeson was cast in 1930 in London as Othello for the first time, it was tremendously controversial because Othello is a tragedy, and the tragedy is about the human condition. And if you're saying a black man could be the protagonist of a tragedy, you're saying a black man is human. So, of course, during the slave period, that was insanely controversial. And so for Robeson to play that role caused this tremendous controversy. And it was really the making of his career when he managed successfully to win over the audience in London in 1930 in this role that many people thought he would be unable to do.
Now, it isn't a straightforward biography, just as Mumbo Jumbo isn't a straightforward novel. I think that's fair for me to say, isn't it, Ishmael? After
well,
all these
Mumbo
years.
Mumbo Jumbo is based upon, it uses original playbills, sort of like a mix of fiction and nonfiction, and, you know, it uses graphics. As a matter of fact, the New York Times referred to Mumbo Jumbo as the pioneer graphics novel before such novels were being written, so my associates included painters and musicians, and instead of following the straight linear novel, I was influenced by both those arts.
So I think I said right at the beginning, the jazz groove virus is a sort of liberating madness, isn't it, which is spread by black artists who are referred to as the jazz groove carriers or the JGCs. How did you come
I think that black arts have been noted as being more life affirmative in a civilization that according to the Puritans, it has a closing act that ends in death and destruction. I think that's still a mentality in this country, that, you know, this whole fervor about the end times, the final destruction of the world, whereas jazz poses a counter narrative, which is life-affirming and something about ecstasy. As a matter of fact, there was the late German scholar, Gunther Lenz, who actually had a jazz magazine, said that the Germans wanted something more life-affirming than the sort of like warrior culture and mythology that inspired the events of the 1930s in Germany.
But it also has voodoo in it, doesn't it? So Papa Labas, who's the sort of central...
Well, that was a primitive... we were not informed when we were going to school here in the United States under what I would call a colonial curriculum, that African religion survived the slave trade. We had no knowledge of this. And so when we talk about voodoo, we're actually talking about African religion that has followers all over the United States and in South America and Central America. Nobody told us about this. So this is a part of my research of constructing what I call a forgotten religion, but it wasn't so forgotten. Did you follow me?
Yeah.
And some pioneers like Catherine Dunham and Zollner Hurston had already written about this, but I was not aware of these works at the time. When I wrote Mumbo Jumbo might be considered a cultural nationalist novel because Malcolm X, it was because of Malcolm X that we got ethnic studies. After Malcolm X was murdered, the reaction from people like members of Bobby Seale of the Black Panthers, Nathan Hare, and others was to inaugurate ethnic studies in universities and colleges. It began as black studies. So, you know, Mumbo Jumbo was a part of that cultural nationalist movement.
And it's being described as Afrofuturist.
Yes, absolutely. Afrofuturism before there's, as a matter of fact, I'm considered one of like the grandfathers of Afrofuturism. My first novel, The Freelance Fallbearers, which is now being touted by PBS as, or NPR, excuse me, as one of the eight novels to read about the current situation in the United States, was published in 1967, and it was nominated for a Nebula Award by the science fiction writer Jose Farmer.
You, as well as all this, the Jez Grew virus and things, you've also got ancient Cathars and Wallflower Order that's trying to make a perfect talking android, which is a black man who will renounce African-American culture in favour of European-American culture. So it's got sort of quite a lot of, one might say today, Dan Brown stuff in it.
Well, you know, I think what happened in the 1960s was that there was an upsurge of a revolutionary activity and cultural nationalism and the return to the roots that came from the grassroots. It came from a new print technology where black poets were able to publish their works in chapbooks and take them to the barbershops, and there was a big television show where, you know, black poets read their work. So this is considered, this vernacular that was considered so subversive that there's been a backlash. And so what they've done is they brought in assimilation, so black academics to be spokesperson for, you know, African-American culture. I need a gloss, a post-colonial glossary to understand what they're saying sometimes, you know. So this has been the reaction to what happened in the 1960s. It's been a counter-revolution. While we were experimenting in our writing, especially in poetry, the backlash occurred when some of the major novelists returned to the, some kind of Faulknerian style, you know, like a traditional style. So that's what's happened here in the United States. But there was a upsurge because, you know, we found a rival history or a forgotten history or culture that had been suppressed, and that's part of the 1960s contribution mm-hmm. to black culture.
Mm-hmm. So now I'm going to bring us back to Robeson here. He was forging his own revolution, but 40 years earlier, wasn't he? But he tried to do it in a different way. There's really touching stuff about his relationship with the South Wales miners and his involvement in the general strike of 1926.
Yeah, I mean, Robeson had been politicised from an early stage growing up in Jim Crow America, but he always said that he learnt his radicalism when he was here in England. So he came to England in the 20s, in the late 20s, and then in the early 30s he came into contact, well, four different sources of his politics. He came into contact with the labour movement, in particular the miners of Wales, and the film The Proud Valley is a dramatisation of a comparison he would often make between his experience growing up as a member of an oppressed people in a small town where religion and church was very important and discovering the same thing in Wales. But he was also became into contact with African students who were studying in London, and they talked to him about the decolonisation that was happening around the world. Then he became conscious of the rising threat of fascism in Europe and famously became involved in the Spanish Civil War, travelled to Spain to sing to the anti-fascists there. And finally, he came into contact with the Soviet Union, and he was a partisan of the Soviet Union from about 1935 for the rest of his life.
If you're a writer, author or poet, you probably need a website to get your name out there. Squarespace templates are so easy to use, you'll have a beautiful website up and running in no time at all. Head to squarespace.com/guardian and enter the offer code GuardianBooksPod to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. And then you can get back to writing that manuscript. There is a suggestion in your book that he was driven mad by the contradictions, that his inability to reconcile what was becoming increasingly obvious about the Soviet Union and his belief in it, because he saw it as a place where there was no racial discrimination, unlike everywhere else he'd been in his life.
I mean, I want to be a little bit careful about that, because even diagnosing depression today is obviously a very problematic endeavour, and doing it historically is even more difficult. But in 1961, he was found unconscious in his hotel room in Moscow. He tried to slit his wrists, and I think you can say there's probably a series of differences. I think being Paul Robeson would always have been a very difficult thing, to be a prodigy from such an early age, to have the expectations of so many people riding on you. And people often thought that what he did was effortless, whereas in fact those close to him said that it cost him a tremendous effort to be as successful as he was all the time. So that was part of it. But I also think there was a sense that by the end of his life he felt that the Soviet Union was not necessarily what he thought it out to be, that he'd made it so central to his identity, and he was becoming conscious that things hadn't worked out the way that he wanted to. And there was a sense of despair that he hadn't been able to deliver the kind of victory that he'd kind of expected that he would be able to deliver, and he suddenly didn't know what to do.
Now, you're a white Australian and he's a black American. Why did you choose to do this subject?
It's a variety of different reasons. I came across Robeson when I was working in a left-wing bookshop in Melbourne, and an older generation of people were dying and they were donating their books, and I would discover that they were all reading about Paul Robeson. He was this man who had meant so much to these people a continent away, and yet I had barely heard of him. But Robeson, of course, famously came to Australia in 1960. He gave the very first concert at the Sydney Opera House, before the Sydney Opera House had been built. He sang to the workers who were building it. And it's this amazing kind of moment where the symbolism is so poignant. He's saying to these builders, these white builders' labourers, when the White Australia policy is still in force, he's saying, we have a common interest, and all of the culture, all of the good things in life that are denied to you, no one's expecting you to ever go to this concert hall that you're building. These things are also relevant to you, and one day you should have them all. And it seems to me that that's a message that's tremendously important today. I mean, Robeson saw himself as part of an international movement, and I think that kind of internationalism is something we need more of in a very nationalistic period today.
So in both these, there's some extent of sort of looking back with affection for a period of uprising, although, you know, in periods of oppression. Ishmael, what your novel gets is a sort of fantastic energy and a fantastic point at which lots and lots of ideas were pouring into the same space as lots and lots of different music styles.
Yes, well, you know, I think that regarding Robeson, many of the black intellectuals and political leaders left the Communist Party in 1938 after what they considered was a betrayal. This is what Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man is all about. Hmm. When the purpose of the Communist Party of the United States was to save the workers' nation, the Soviet Union, and in doing so, they abandoned what blacks considered black issues here at home, like police brutality, foreclosures, dispossession. That's what Ellison and Richard Wright were upset about, is that they felt betrayed by the Communist Party. So that alliance was broken up. As a matter of fact, I wrote a play about it called The Final Version, in which I talked about that pivotal moment when Adam Clayton Powell Jr., many of the leaders in Harlem, left the Communist Party, or in an alliance that they made with the Communist Party, because the Communist Party was more concerned about rescuing the Soviet Union. So this issue still exists today, where Bernie Sanders, Democrats, and others on the left believe that class is the fundamental factor that restricts movement in American life, while blacks still say it's race. And this is still an argument that we have. So Paul Robeson, perhaps naively, believed that, you know, racism didn't exist in communist societies, while one of his contemporaries, Ollie Harrington, a cartoonist who went into exile, he said that East Germany was the most racist place he ever went to. So I think that when you talk about, you know, Australian writers, such as your other guests, and Europeans, they have a different take on race and class than people in the United States, where the whites have become white. They've lost all traces of ethnicity, and they vote against their interests. That's always the criticism from blacks, Latinos, Native Americans, and others, and Hispanics, of whites, so-called whites, is that they vote against their interests because they choose race above class.
Now, I just want to go back into the music, and there's a whole sort of style issue, isn't there, and a choice of repertoire. So Robeson chose the spiritual. That was one of the things that he resuscitated.
Well, he was in this awful racist musical called Showboat, where they use the term darky. I mean, it's like a really insulting musical. And he's also in some terrible Hollywood movie called Sanders of the Congo or something. Sometimes he goes accompanying this this colonial surrounding as he massacres black natives left and right. So, and you know, his personal life also got him into trouble, I believe, if I might raise that issue.
What do you say about that, Jeff?
Yeah, there's a whole lot to unpack there. Yes, I mean, the spirituals were the basis of Robeson's repertoire. And at the time when he came to the spirituals, I mean, W.B. Du Bois had been championing them, but there were a lot of other intellectuals from the Harlem Renaissance who saw the spirituals as a legacy of the past that they wanted to forget and were championing classical music and, in fact, were quite hostile to jazz and to blues. And so when Robeson gave the first performance of a concert solely dedicated to the spirituals in 1925, it was this tremendous revelation for a lot of people to hear, well, what W.B. Du Bois had always talked about, the beauty of this music and also its ability to speak to a contemporary generation, where these songs that had been written under slavery were also conveying other messages about yearning for freedom, about overcoming oppression, and spoke not only to a new generation in Harlem, but Robeson subsequently took them to people all over the world. So when he came to Australia in 1960, as well as singing for the workers at the Opera House, he made a point of meeting with Indigenous activists. He famously met with Faith Bandler, who's a very famous leader of Indigenous people in Australia, and was absolutely horrified at the conditions faced by Australian Aborigines in Australia. But he and Bandler had this bond over the spirituals, which had meant a tremendous amount to her growing up as a black woman in Australian country towns, where there was something very close to Jim Crow in Australia as well. And it's sort of an example, I guess, of how this music was able to convey sentiments to people all over the world.
One difference is that whereas in a biography you're going back to the period in which the person was, therefore you're investigating the attitudes that were there then. In a novel like Mumbo Jumbo, Ishmael, am I not right in saying that what you're looking back from the 1970s to the 1920s, so you're overlaying a whole 50 years of sensibility onto it?
Yes, well, I think that the 1920s, the Harlem Renaissance, was probably a period of more imitation than the 1960s, although I do, you know, try to compare the two eras. In the 1960s, the grassroots writers designed a sort of like off-campus curriculum, if I can put it that way. They began to study Arabic. They began to study African languages. They began to use vernacular. There's a renaissance of James Baldwin's work that's happening in the United States because of a film that's been produced. But James Baldwin, his model for writing was Henry James and Charles Dickens. That was all erased in the 1960s, where writers were more impressed by the kind of language that the people spoke, especially people like Amiri Baraka and writers like that. So I think there was a cultural transformation that occurred in the 1960s, and the only... there were a few who were interested in that kind of work in the 1920s, and that was maybe Zora Hurston, Langston Hughes, and writers like that.
Yeah, Jeff is nodding.
Langston Hughes in particular. I said before that there were many intellectuals from that period who were suspicious, perhaps, of jazz and blues, but Langston Hughes was not one of them, and his ability to sort of convey the energy of the music, I think, makes his work stands up, I think, incredibly well today.
That was Jeff Sparrow. His book No Way But This is published by Scribe and is out now. The reissue of Mumbo Jumbo by Ishmael Reed is with Penguin Classics. Next week on the podcast, we'll take a look at the long list for this year's Man Booker Prize. Can't wait? Well, The Guardian has lots of wonderful podcasts to help you while away the time on politics, science, technology, global development. And if you like longer form journalism but don't always have the time to read it for yourself, you can catch up with our Audio Long Reads podcast. They're all there on theguardian.com/podcasts, which is where, of course, you'll find us too. Just start up your favourite podcast app and search for Guardian Books Podcast. And you can join the conversation too, either by commenting on the Guardian website or at Guardian Books on Twitter. But for now, from me, Claire Armitstead, and my producer, Susanna Trezillian, goodbye and thanks for listening. We leave you with Paul Robeson singing in 1949 for the Scottish Miners.
When you see a miner and a film star together, the husky one's the miner. Well, usually. And before he went away, of course, they asked him to sing.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I ain't dead. Says Joe, but I ain't dead. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize. Went on to organize. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.